Hello, sex fans, and welcome back. Today is Monday, May 28th, 2012, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge. And I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick.
Hey, what's up, kiddo? Daddy says you're wearing a sad face. Ain't good to have a sad face. Hey, how'd you like the coloring book? Would you like that?
Ooh, a coloring book. I would like that. The bad boy of erotica, the extraordinarily talented Matthew Klickstein, is back for part two of our conversation for this The Erotic Mind series. Matthew has a knack for riling folks up, don't you know? I love that about him. There's nothing namby-pamby about this author. He speaks his mind not just eruditely, but with passion and conviction. And since last week's reading from his novel Ragdoll caused such a stir, I will insist that Matthew read again this week. You can be sure that it will leave you at least a little bit unsettled. But wait, you didn't miss part one of this controversial conversation, did you? Well, not to worry if you did, because you can find it and all of my podcasts in the podcast archive on my site, drdicksexadvice.com. All you got to do is use the search function in the header, type in podcast number 333, and voila! But don't forget to use the pound sign when you do your search.
Now come on down to the car and let's all be friends.
That may have to wait until the show is over. For more about Matthew, his new book, and his amazing career, visit Oysters and Chocolate Erotic at oystersandchocolate.com. Use the search function in their header and type in Matthew Klickstein. That's Matthew with just one T, mind you. Today's podcast is brought to you by Dr. Dick's Stockroom. You'll find this treasure trove of sexually stimulating toys, implements, and fetish wear and gear right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the Dr. Dick's Stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site. You'll surely enjoy shopping at Dr. Dick's Stockroom because it's just so damn fun and, I might add, easy. Yes-a-ree, sex fans, you can spare yourself the embarrassment of skulking down to your local sex emporium to pick up all those nasty toys you've been drooling over. You can forget about seedy storefronts in unsavory neighborhoods, and you don't have to worry about leering salesmen scrutinizing what you buy. Why? Because you shop from the privacy of your own computer. That's why.
Kiddo, I understand how you feel. But you don't have to worry. One of these days you're going to be just as pretty as Mademoiselle. Maybe prettier.
God, I hope so. Thanks to Dr. Dick's Stockroom, it's never been easier or more discreet to be a big fat pervert. So be sure to take a moment out of your hectic schedule and visit my stockroom today. And remember, a portion of every sale comes back to us as support for these shows. How great is that? Okay, on with the show. Matthew Klickstein, welcome back, and thank you for joining us here at drdicksexadvice.com for this Erotic Mind podcast. Part two. What a week. Holy cow. We heard from, or I did. I don't know about you. I heard from a lot of people who had lots to you gave them lots to think about in last week's presentation or our chat. So maybe we should get right back at it so we don't waste any time messing around when we could be talking about you and your work. So let me begin precisely where we left off last week. And you read from your book Ragdoll, and now I want to talk a little bit about some of the reviews that you're getting. One person wrote, "It's horrible. It's erotic. I want to crawl up inside it and sleep there for a month. It's disgusting. I can't put it down. I don't want anyone to see me reading it. I read parts of it aloud to myself in the bathroom, just to hear the words spoken, to hear them formed by the human throat. Some parts were dirty in the worst way. Some parts were dirty in the best." You gotta love reviews that begin, "It's horrible." You must be very proud.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it's sort of like what I was talking about last week, where Jordan and Samantha and I have been very aware that this would cause some ripples, even in a allegedly uninhibited world as erotica, and that certainly has not been true. So, you know, it's been a lot of fun for us to see the great dichotomy of different kinds of reviews we've received. And I think that review is the best at having both the horrible and the glorious at once, which
right.
is exactly what Herodica is and exactly what Ragdoll, this book, is all about.
Right.
So,
somebody else said, if Showgirls is all about Eve with tits, then Ragdoll is the 7-year itch with throat fucking. Another person writes, Ragdoll reads like American Psycho, but instead of murder, sexual perversion is a crime. I love it.
I make reference a lot in some interviews and things I've been doing to American Psycho. And, you know, Bret Easton Ellis had to go through a lot of the same tribulations that I have with this. His, even in the pre-production phase, I don't know if you're aware of it.
Right.
But the, you know, Simon & Schuster was notorious for dropping him. And even the person who had done the cover for his first, I believe it was 3 books that he had done, refused to do the cover for American Psycho. And again, I think it's a great example of a book that I'm a huge fan of that book. I don't particularly care for what Bret Easton Ellis has done in his last couple of novels. But I think that American Psycho, as with a lot of people, is really probably the great American novel of the 90s and really encapsulated what that time was about, and also extremely well written. Even the parts that were a bit sloppy and messy, as with certain scenes in some of F. Scott Fitzgerald's books, I think were meant to be uncomfortable and meant to be, you know, again, even like the way that Webern works with atonal music, atonal classic music. I think it had to have been written a certain way to really bring that out. And I had such a visceral experience reading American Psycho when I was younger. I really not felt that in other books I've read, even books that I like much more, like Don Quixote or Gulliver's Travels. But to get that kind of visceral experience while reading American Psycho is something that I was really aspiring toward in Ragdoll. And I always say, you know, Ragdoll makes American Psycho read like Song of the South. I was trying to take that next level in a few ways.
Let me ask you, how did you come upon this edgy horror your first time out as an erotica writer, as opposed to writing something sweet and breathless and romantic and kissy-kissy like most people do?
You know, it's funny you say that, Richard, because I just recently, over Cinco de Mayo weekend, met a lovely young girl and very Winona Ryder-esque, big doll eyes and the short tousled black hair, artist assistant, of course. And we got to talking quite a bit over phone and while we were hanging out and so forth. And at one point she actually asked me outright, she goes, Matt, you're such a nice guy and you're so good to me, because I had a helper one of the nights at one of the parties, you know, she was a little drunk and whatnot. She said, you know, you're so nice to these girls and to me, why do you end up writing, you know, this stuff that you write, you know? And I kind of didn't say anything for a moment. I said, I think that those two things are very related. You know, I think erotica is really about fantasy. And at the end of the day, as I definitely have a mouth on me, and my mom could attest to that. But at the end of the day, I have a really good heart. And I'm very sincere and very honest. And I do protect and take care of my friends. And, you know, I've worked with people with disabilities through most of my life. And I really have a great deal of empathy for people in general, for the most part. And, you know, I try to be a good person. Now, I also am a very frustrated young artist, and I have a lot on my mind about the way that the world works and the way that women and men relationships work. And, you know, I've read a lot of books and I've read a lot of history, and a lot upsets me and frustrates me. I am a very sensitive person, and that goes both ways. I can be very nice, but also in my mind a lot of the time. And again, I think you see this in people like R. Crumb in particular, who's a real hero of mine. You know, you get very frustrated and angry that the rest of the world's not very nice and the rest of the world's not very sensitive or intelligent or educated or hardworking. And so, you know, rather than taking it out on other people or, you know, getting in fights or getting arrested or living a life of crime, I've been given a gift of writing, which I've always had, and I'm very grateful for. It's just there. And so I channel that kind of hatred and frustration and concern and nervousness into my writing. And so it's the easiest thing for me to write. Even the material I've written in the past that's not erotic tends to be very dark and tends to be very existential. There's usually a fair amount of black humor in it, as there is in Ragdoll. I think it was axiomatic for me. I started writing, and you know, I ended up doing something that was very much in line with Lolita, and very much, you know, the both that dichotomy that I just talked about. Oliver Maxwell, the protagonist in Ragdoll, is a nice guy. He's taking care of this girl. He's washing her. He's cleaning her. He goes and gets tampons for her at one point, even though he doesn't know what he should get, and he really has no idea what he's doing. He's very scared. He's scared of getting in trouble. This is not a bad guy necessarily. He's just a little screwed up and doesn't really understand how the world works, because he's kind of this loner. And so he ends up, doing these deranged, terrible things at night in order to keep himself from taking advantage of this girl that he's trying to take care of. And, funnily enough, without any real spoilers, a lot of the times it ends up in a situation where he's punished for getting involved in these deranged things at night. The universe is, moral and not amoral, even though he believes it to be more existential. So I think that it's all in there in Ragdoll, and that's very much who I am and the way I think our society is. And I think the quintessence of the young male artist.
Samantha and Jordan said that you guys are marketing Ragdoll directly to the horror audience. I think that's totally cool. Do you suppose these folks will balk at the erotic nature of the story, or is that just par for the course, or a little add-on, actually, maybe?
I think it's definitely a little add-on. I think the two realms are very much linked. They're cousins, really. And, you know, a lot of my friends, even, who are very much in the horror world, have said, erotica, that's nothing new. And I said, well, no, but we named it first. You know, it's kind of like when people finally came up with the name grunge for music. That kind of music had been going on for at least 20 years. That someone finally said, let's call it grunge. So I think the two realms of horror and erotica are very much linked, because they're about fantasy. They're about going to the farthest limits that you can, whether it's with blood and guts or whether it's with, nudity and sex. In fact, there's a new genre that's been coming out over the last few years called torture porn. Unfortunately, there have been some really bad eggs like Eli Roth with Hostel and films that just frankly aren't very good. But there are other people doing some really interesting underground films that are almost approaching snuff. They're, of course, not. Some of them have some pretty big stars in them. Mm-hmm. But basically, it really shows that people are getting off on the violence, and they're getting very innovative in these films. And some of them are quite good. There was a remake that just came out called Mother's Day with Rebecca De Mornay in it. And it's not only a very frightening film, but it's very innovative in what they do. They're not just, cutting off fingers and such. Some of the torture that they do, it's disgusting and it's terrible and it's graphic and it haunts you. But there's also a moment where you go, gee, that's really interesting. I would have never thought of that before. Someone really thought about that. And I think the best example, a film that, mainstream audiences might not ever see, that I've really become fond of over the last couple of weeks, is something called The Bunny Game. That was created by just a very small group of actors and filmmakers, all completely improvised, and it's torture porn at its most base, fundamental level. But it's a beautiful film. It is rendered in gorgeous black and white film. It really harkens back to classic purist cinema. The music and sound design is terrific. It's completely engaging the entire film. It never gets boring. Some of the scenes are extremely graphic, and very clearly a lot of what's going on is real, is actually happening. But what's interesting about it is the young woman in it, who apparently is a very outspoken feminist musician, she helped to write the film because it was improvised. She helped to develop it. So you're watching her getting completely tortured and beaten up and her hair shaved and some really terrible things that clearly a lot of it's actually being done. But she took power from that, and she made that happen in real life. And it's a beautiful film, The Bunny Game. I hope that people can look it up and maybe demand that their theaters or whatnot show it. We're actually trying to get in touch with the people who made it about Ragdoll, because I think they would be great to make a film out of Ragdoll. And just, I think they're coming from a lot of the same places that we came when we decided to put out Ragdoll, which is finding that place where, the horror and the sex can really come together in a way that's innovative and new and fresh, and also bespeaks a lot about gender roles and about what is moral and what is not moral.
Why do you suppose we need this? Apparently we do, because there's a proliferation of it. Some, as you suggest, is very good, but the vast majority of it is mediocre to terrible. Why do we have to have this? We need it, and so why?
Catharsis.
Ah, good. Interesting.
We live in a world, especially the Western society, that again, everyone is very much the protagonist and ragdoll. Oliver Maxwell, a lot of people I know are girls and guys. You know, people who are very afraid and very nervous and very confused. Richard, you know, I believe you're a bit older than I. You know, I'm a 30-year-old man, and I, you know, I've been
old enough to be your older
friend.
No,
yeah,
your older friend. Yes, exactly. No, father.
When I was in college, for example, a lot of my friends and I were very confused by what was going on in the sexual world. And frankly, you know, a lot of people were getting in trouble who I really don't think should have been, because we were so confused. And even the girls were very confused by what they were supposed to do or what they were not supposed to do. And, you know, you have these movies and these TV shows and these books even and comic books and this music doing one thing. And you have these other people who are doing something else, and you have these speeches that are being given, and, you know, are they being raped or are they just drunk? And it becomes extremely confusing. And I think the worst part about all of this, Richard, and why I think it's really important to have things like Ragdoll out there and Robert Crumb and, you know, more people like Bukowski and Henry Miller and Elfriede Jelinek, the great Austrian writer, who's a woman, funnily enough, and writes a lot about this kind of stuff, you know, Nobel Prize winner, is because we need to admit to ourselves that nobody knows what we're doing, and it's all very confusing, and that we really need to be a lot more careful about, you know, again, getting, you know, people in trouble or who we say, you know, raped whom and who we said sexual harassed whom, and just everyone becomes so afraid of each other. And boy, that when everyone's that afraid, it really leads everyone to what? Go home and watch TV, buy things online, play video games, chat with people they don't even know online, maybe get in really big trouble, you know, with doing stuff like that. And so I think it makes it so frightening. It makes the world so frightening to not have this kind of stuff, to not have that release. There's a reason that the earth has earthquakes every now and then. And if there's not enough earthquakes, you know, we're going to explode. And I think it's very much the same thing with this kind of material, whether it's film, music, art, literature, or whatever it might be. We need to have that catharsis of someone having to come out there and say, hey, it's okay to think these thoughts, and it's okay to be worried and nervous and scared and angry and frustrated and lustful, and to think some of the things that you might think that you're being told from one side is bad, but one side's okay, and just let's just all come out there together and have some fun with it. And let's have some entertainment with it. Let's have a few jokes, maybe. Even, you know, that movie I was talking about, The Bunny Game, it's also very funny in a lot of parts. You know, I think that's really, really important. And I'll end with, there was a scene of that in Italy after a lot of the Italian neorealistic work called Giallo, which was where a lot of our modern gory horror comes from. You had a lot of these films, you know, these people like Dario Argento and so forth, who were making these movies that were really, you know, women just getting torn up in blood and guts and, you know, all this stuff with this great classic music and beautiful camera work and very interesting acting and very interesting editing. And they were going so wild with it, and there was a lot of violence and blood and horror. You know, I think it came out of people just needed that release after World War II and then neorealism, which was still really delving into, well, why did World War II happen and why are we like this? That they just had to say, fuck it. Let's just, you know, throw some blood against the camera. Let's have some hot bitch with blonde hair show her tits. Let's cut her up. Let's chase her around the castle. And let's just have some fun and screw around with it. A lot of those movies deal with feminism and with maternity and with pregnancy and with things that, you know, they're dealing with it in a way that I think is very interesting and very important and very, at the end, very psychological. Right. So,
you know, one of these days, I want to have a complete conversation with you just about what you were talking there about. One of my concerns, I don't know if it's a concern, like bad concern or a good concern, is that the I see that women are generally the ones being pursued and hacked apart and all that kind of stuff, and they're being hacked apart and pursued by men as opposed to the other way around. I would find it so refreshing to see, you know, women pursuing men in that way, because it's, you know, it gets to the point sometimes of it being so trite, you know, like, oh, it's women being victimized again. And I think that's the knee-jerk response that a lot of people, not just, you know, feminists, have about this kind of stuff, is that, you know, women are always on the receiving end.
My defense against that, I disagree, because what you have to remember is, and this really confuses me, especially with the onslaught of reality television, or what happened with James Frey or Fry and A Million Little Fibers, for example, where you sit there and you say, well, none of this is real. None of this, it's all being manipulated and created and produced. And when you consider that, you have to consider who's creating it. Mm-hmm. As I just said, the Bunny Game was written, the girl in it got credit.
Yeah.
And, you know, the film version of American Psycho wasn't just written and directed by two women, but also two very powerful, very proactive, very vocal lesbians, mm-hmm. one of whom, Mary Herron, you know, she also made the Betty Page movie, but she created a punk magazine with Legs McNeil and some of the others back in the 70s, which was a real counterculture thing. I think where people get confused is the same way that they get confused about Gracie Allen or Lucille Ball. Or even, you know, I just watched 7 Year Itch again after I got that review, and I watched and I went, Marilyn Manson. She is a genius in that movie.
Absolutely. She totally is.
And it's because Gracie Allen, Marilyn Monroe, and Lucille Ball, they are playing the blonde ditz, and they are playing this character. But at the end of the day, as we all know and learn, Gracie Allen was writing most of that stuff. George Burns was
about her. Absolutely.
Lucille Ball was creating that show. She invented the three-camera.
Yes, that's so true.
You know, and I said the same thing with when I watched 7 Year Itch again. I was watching Marilyn Monroe. She is so consistent in that film. You know, it's not just being the blonde ditz. You know, she knew what she was doing. She was very aware of it. And there are even certain movies, again, from that giallo era, where you watch a movie like Pasolini's Salo, where there are women in it even who are taking very much power and are the ones who are doing a lot of the bad things. Or a very underground film that some friends of mine and I just unearthed called The Frightened Woman, which is such, you know, anybody listening to this, please go and see The Frightened Woman, because it is a perfect example of a film that starts with the woman is being terrorized, the woman is being haunted, the woman is being chased and abused, but then the movie completely changes. It literally becomes a totally different film, and I don't want to give it away, but, you know, it's actually a very similar ending to Ragdoll, where it's like, wait a second, who's really in charge here?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, and you have to remember, a lot of these actresses who are in these films, they were taking a lot of control, and they were saying what they would do and would not do and how they wanted to do it. I think it all goes into third wave feminism, and I think you get the same kind of argument with should women be stripping or not, or should they be.
Absolutely. I totally agree, and that's one of the reasons why I want to have that conversation with you, because, I mean, there's no one better situated to walk us through that minefield. But since our time is very limited, and I would be absolutely remiss if I didn't beg you to read again, can you?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Yippee!
There we go. This part's a little bit longer. It's another excerpt from episode 14 this time, which is actually my favorite episode. So it's a little bit longer, but hopefully I'll get it in. If it starts becoming a little too long, just let me know. Here we go. So this is an excerpt from episode 14, so we're getting near the end here. What? Christ, he thought. She wasn't going to freak. She was one. You're not supposed to... She mellowed out at the realization that she was with a newbie here. In her earlier, softer tone, merely maternal, look, you hold my head down into the water for as long as I can take it, okay? and then I'll tap you on the leg 3 times. You let a few more seconds pass by before pulling me up and out. Got it? Really? Yeah, now come on and get back on top of me. That felt good with your dick like that across my ass. Just use me as a stool. Hurry up, I want to have an orgasm before I got to get back to my dad. Speaking of assholes. On her hands and knees, she crawled further into the water, and he crouched back down on her, stretching his dick, which was already in remission, along her crack. Good. Just rest yourself on me. Nice. All right. Now don't fuck up this time, and maybe I'll let you come in my mouth or something. just go. Jesus, let's go. He snatched at a clump of her cold, wet sunset hair. Ow! Good, like that, she said. And he drove her face back into the water, gripping her sides with his knees as though she were a horse. Bubbles geysered up and out of the water from her mouth. He held her head down, rocking up against her backside, his balls kissing her ass cheeks, his dick clogging the vertical indentation between her tight, smooth alabaster buttocks. Oliver peered up at the moon above him, which was covered once more by stringy gray clouds, and something evil took over, the sense of power surging through his body and hand as he shoved her fucking face deeper into the icy liquid, trying to smash her adorable button nose into the rocky lake bottom. All those ridiculous girls, take this. He was sneering, his teeth grinding, his hand pushing her face into the rocks, his cock driving against her ass, riding her like a fucking mechanical horse outside a grocery store, breathing harshly through his nose, his mouth clamped shut, the rage overtaking him completely, he allowing it, growing strong from it, his grip on her hair tightening impossibly, his grating her face against the rocks underwater, bubbles percolating pell-mell all around her head, popping loudly as though they were those of a child blowing into a straw dipped in dark cola, his fingers so tightly clutching the clump of her hair that his muscles were straining, and her ass was wriggling, her right hand clapping the water hard and loud. He knew she was starting to drown. Good. Her feet facing the ground behind him flopped convulsively against the pebbly shore as he jammed her face deeper into the rocky lake bottom. The rest of her body burst into its own series of short convulsions, her very skin trembling, vibrating, and it felt amazing as he rocked faster and faster, his dick pumping the tight vertical space between her buttocks that tensed so taut that he could have bounced off it into the air. He snarled, lips curling back over his clenched teeth, and put all his fury into his right arm to apply more pressure to the back of her head, hoping her entire face would shatter against the lake bottom. Fucking slut doing this to him. The bubbles were everywhere, and he had long forgotten how cold it was, numb to everything but his dictatorial anger, which ignited his yearning to really drown her now. Below his clasping hair, he felt the resistance of the rock against her skin, that he was scratching her face up, something awful, could visualize the bloody, torn flesh streaks across her forehead and eyelids. No one would ever want to playfully twist that nose of hers again. He was riding her back and forth, sliding his erect cock over her ass crack, looking down at it to see her right hand no longer flapping the water, but curling back with her tentacle arm toward her body, reaching down under her belly to finger herself steadily, the bubbles boiling in the water before her, the girl's fingers working her pussy beneath him. He rode her like a champ, her feet flopping loudly against the pebbled shore behind them, and his hand screwing her face into the very earth, pedal to the metal. She pulled her hand away from her vagina and tapped on his leg once, twice, thrice. He didn't know why at first, as she squirmed and gyrated, rising up and down off the ground, too small a frame to make a move much at all, and then he recalled what she had said, realized what he had been doing, flashed on the metal bars of his awaiting jail cell, slamming home, and yanked her head out of the water in a crystalline flurry of explosive cold wetness. He jumped away, falling to the side of her while she respired and sucked at the freezing air, her skin literally blue and blood dripping down with the water and mucus covering her face, as though she had just been born, throwing up water and bile and orange chunks still on her hands and knees, panting, coughing, hacking, gagging. He wanted to come so badly onto her unicorned ass that was poking out from behind her, wanted to deface that foolish cartoon tattoo. She wobblingly held herself up off the ground and forcefully retched. Mystifyingly, she pointed at him with her finger while coughing, her face torn up as though put through a thresher, calling out to him through meek breaths. Cock! At first, Oliver thought she was insulting him, but then she reached out and pulled at his still hard dick. In My mouth. She belched up muddy, steaming water. The amount would have been unbelievable had he not been there to witness it for himself, the wretched sound of her guttural ejection making him want to do the same. He got up on his knees, and with her freezing hand, she speared her own gasping fish mouth with his dick. Coming almost as soon as it entered, she aggressively siphoning the entirety of his semen, pumping into her throat before she pulled away, collapsing backwards under the ground behind her, arms splayed out in either direction on her sides, breathing and coughing, the color of her skin normalizing. Oliver stayed there on his knees, rising out of the pointy pebbles of the shore, petrified in awed shock, before doing what came most naturally after coming, holding his dick over her picturesque lake bottom face, covered in blood, semen, spit, and mud, and let loose a stream of warm, steaming piss all over her face. At first, she kept her eyes and lips closed, blowing bubbles with his micturition as though she were one of those playful, cum-guzzling sluts from his online porn sites, but soon her lips relaxed into a sexy pout, and she shook her head indulgently like a girl in a luxurious shampoo commercial, gleefully showering in his gracious liquid. A vineyard of steam emanated from off of her face and neck where he pissed on her as though putting out a fire. He'd never done anything like that before, but it seemed to make sense. She closed her eyes, and a satisfied Cheshire Cat smile grew out of her lips as he shook the last few drops onto her chin, wiping his penis across her scratched-up, flesh-exposed face. He sat back and stared off irresolutely into space, not quite at her. That, she said, her breathing subdued to a normal cadence now, that was a good one. Oliver shook his head in repentant disbelief. He began collecting his shoes, his pants, putting everything back on, his body recalling how fucking freezing it was. See you around sometime, she said with that lilting voice that originally endeared her to him. She did not move away from turning her head, and with her closed eyes reminded him, watch out for my glasses, by the way. You want me to drive you back to your dad, he asked. Nah, I'll be fine here for a minute. I'm still glowing from the orgasm. Thanks.
Well then.
I think that says it all.
It does, it does, it does. It just exactly... what we were talking about just before you read. Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you so much for this,
sure.
Matthew. This has been extraordinary. Before we go, could you tell us again where we can buy your book? Because I know everybody in our audience, well, most everyone, anyhow, is going to want to run right out and get it.
Yes, and, you know, as the review says, you know, you can read it by yourself, you can read it alone, don't be scared. It's quite a book to read, and it does have a moral ending, so don't worry too much. But now, you can find Ragdoll, a erotica novel, at oystersandchocolate.com. And it's also on a lot of the, Smashwords and Goodreads and some of those others, but oystersandchocolate.com is the best place to
right.
go.
Because it's our friend site.
Exactly. It's Samantha and Jordan, they're the ones responsible for putting out this smart smut, I should say. And so go there and check it out.
Is this an ebook alone, or is it hardcover too?
Right now it's just an ebook.
I see, good.
Just started doing
all right.
Novels, so they're just starting with ebooks, and
right.
hopefully at some point we'll start doing it some
right,
printouts.
Right, right, right. Sure. You are absolutely amazing. It has been such a wonderful opportunity to meet you and hear your brilliant rap about your work and erotica in general. I know we will be speaking again, and until we do, we will be visiting you in cyberspace. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Okay, be well. Bye now.
You too. Bye-bye.
What a great show, huh? Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Tune in next week at this time for my annual interview with Clayton Hibbert, the artistic director of the Seattle Erotic Art Festival. And more sex advice with an edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick.
But right now, you're going to pick your little ass up. You're going to drop it in the back seat. You're going to cut out the crap. You understand?
I really like how you talk to me like that. And yes, ma'am, I'm almost ready. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's Stockroom. Listen up, you guys. If your sex life needs a little sprucing up, and whose doesn't, I want you to mosey on over to my online sex emporium and pick out something really naughty for yourself or the other pervs in your life. I mean, if you can't find what you're looking for in my stockroom, you'd better call the search off right now.
Dr. Dick has put together a dazzling array of products that will liven up even the most ho-hum sex life. Not sure what to buy? Take a look at my sex toy review site, drdicksextoyreviews.com. It's chock full of swell gift-giving ideas. Look for the Dr. Dick Stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site, and remember, a portion of every sale comes back to us as support for these shows. How great is that? Until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.